Bien, bonjour à nouveau. Merci de vous asseoir. Nous allons commencer le séminaire. Et j'ai vraiment le privilège aujourd'hui d'introduire le professeur Pat Kuhl de l'Université de Washington, de l'État de Washington à Seattle, qui va nous parler aujourd'hui des résultats les plus récents sur l'apprentissage phonologique chez l'enfant. I will switch to English because the talk will be in English. And so welcome, Pat. Thank you for accepting the invitation. I just want to mention that Pat is one of the most brilliant members of the investigators studying how the baby's brain operates and develops. And especially in the domain of language acquisition, she has made absolutely seminal contributions to the understanding of how the baby converges to a specific phonological representation in a specific language. She's using, as you will see, the whole panoply of methods, and recently that includes the most advanced brain imaging methods of MEG, which will become, I believe, a very important tool for the baby's brain. She is a member of the National Academy of Sciences in the USA. She is a member of several other academies in the world. She has received many very important prizes, and that includes the gold medal of the Acoustical Society of America, as well as very recently the Ibsen Signoret Prize, le prix Signoret de la Fondation Ibsen à Paris, il y a quelques semaines. She has also had the privilege of lecturing two American presidents, President Clinton and President Bush, the second, I believe, and not yet Barack Obama, but I hope this will soon come. And she has published a very nice book, which we believe, but I was not sure, I didn't check, is published in French. In English, it's called The Scientist in the Crib, Le Scientifique au Berceau, which is describing how our knowledge of the psychology of the baby in the early years is changing our view of learning and development. So a very accessible and very nice book. It's been translated in 22 languages, I was told, so it's probably available in French, but I don't know the title. It exists, okay. On me confirme qu'il existe en français. Okay, so without further ado, welcome Pat, and thank you very much for coming.
Bonjour, everyone, and merci, Stan, for that nice introduction. I'm very happy to be here today to talk about the very early stages of language acquisition in babies who are learning their first language, and then what happens when you attempt to teach them a second language. And we are using behavioral methods and brain methods, as Stan said, to see what the monolingual brain and the bilingual brain look like. So today I'm going to be talking about language, but I think the lessons from language acquisition will tell us a lot about how the child's mind works and how the combination of biology and culture can produce some of the masterful abilities that humans are capable of. So I'm going to start this morning with the faces of two people who I'm sure you're very familiar with, and they're interesting comments on the acquisition of language. So you have on the one hand here on the right, B.F. Skinner, American psychologist, who argued that the learning of language was very similar to a rat learning to press a bar. When the rat presses a bar and you reinforce that behavior with something that tastes good, the animal will learn the activity to press that bar. But he wrote a book called Verbal Behavior in 1957, and Noam Chomsky from MIT had a scathing comment about that book and said that learning language has nothing to do with a rat learning to press a bar. It's a totally different activity. Chomsky argued that language is more like an organ in the body that grows of its own accord and matures over time, and that the ability to produce a language had more to do with the selection of innately specified options. So these two were very, very different. A learning theorist, a nativist who believed in innate structure, and what was interesting is that neither of these two theorists had a look at the baby. So what's happened in modern psychology, developmental psychology, starting in the 70s with Peter Imus at Brown, people started to look at infants and do very clever experiments to see what is the baby doing to acquire a specific language? How does it work? How does the baby learn? So what I'm going to talk to you about today is a set of experiments that have been done all over the world, not just in America, but in France by Jacques Mahler and a number of people in many countries of the world who have decided that the way to understand learning and the brain is to really examine what young babies can do. So that's what we're going to do today. And what I'll tell you by the end of the day is that the theory that's emerging is not Skinner's operant conditioning. Babies do not learn language by any kind of operant conditioning with careful shaping and reinforcement. That's simply not true. But it's also not perfectly described by what Chomsky argued to be innate structure that is brought about by exposure to a language. It isn't simply that hearing a language triggers an innately specified option. Babies are applying very clever learning methods to the study of language. And the kind of learning they're doing is not described by operant conditioning. The kind of learning they're engaged in is more described by implicit learning mechanisms and implicit memory mechanisms. They are absorbing patterns when they listen to us talk, and some of those patterns have to do with statistical patterning, the patterning over time that can predict the sounds that are used by the language and predict words. And so I'll show you some of that today. So what we'll say is a new theory is emerging. It's not Skinnerian learning. It's not Chomskyan, though Chomsky was much closer than Skinner was to the real answer. But it's something that's merging biology and culture in a very interesting way. So let's look first at this graph. This is a graph that almost no one disputes around the world. It shows that what the biologists called a critical period is well exhibited by language. So if you look at your age on this axis and your skill on this axis, you will see that the babies, when attempting to learn a second language, are geniuses up to about the age of 7. From 0 to 7, if a child is exposed to a second language in a natural setting, the child will simply absorb that language with no effort whatsoever. Past the age of 7, things change. There's a systematic decline in the ability to acquire the language. That doesn't mean that you cannot acquire a second language beyond puberty, but as you approach puberty, the learning becomes different. In this early period, the implicit learning mechanisms are very powerful. And beyond this age, beyond puberty, learning is totally different. And if you learn beyond that age, then the grammar of the language, the phonology of the language, you will speak with an accent, and it will not be automatic for you. Not easy. So what we're trying to do in the laboratory is understand what's the magic. What's the magic that the baby is putting to work that you and I can't put to work anymore? Why does our brain behave differently when you hear a new language than the baby and the young child learning at that period? If we can understand what the baby is doing, perhaps we could create learning methods that would allow you and I to learn a second language as easily as the baby. That would be wonderful. The other reason to understand what's happening here is that it's very important for developmental disabilities, autism, dyslexia, fragile X, specific language impairment. The early years are when these developmental disabilities really make it difficult for the child to acquire normal language and function with normal language if you have this disability. If we understand how typical development is working during that period of time, perhaps we can create interventions that would help these children learn language more easily and when their brain is very, very plastic. So we think it's very important to understand the mechanisms at that time. So a number of studies, this is a complex graph, a number of studies have been done looking at speech perception and speech production in the first year of life, the first 12 months. And all of these boxes represent findings that have been discovered in laboratories across the world. What's interesting from the standpoint of development is that both in perception and production, there is a perceptual narrowing of abilities. If you look very early on at perception and at production, infants start out hearing differences between all the sounds of all languages. And as they move to the first year, perception narrows. So they start out very, very universal and then become more specialized in their perceptual abilities. Same thing with speech production. They start out producing sounds in a universal way, producing sounds that are not the sounds of specific languages, but a general set of sounds that all babies produce. And then by the end of the first year, there is a narrowing of their production. So a lot is happening during the first year. By the time you hear the baby produce the first word, mama or dada, papa, the baby's brain has absorbed many of the characteristics of the language or languages they're listening to. And that listening experience has shaped the brain very, very, very much by that time. So one of the early discoveries is something, this is part of the baby's biology. This is part of what comes from biology and not culture. At the beginning of life, I said that babies could discriminate all contrasts. This was discovered in experiments early on by Peter Imus, published in Science, 1971. If you take a syllable like ba and a syllable like pa, and you create a continuum that marches along, changing the acoustics, perception is not continuous, perception is categorical. Right at this place, babies and adults are very, very good at hearing the change. They hear ba, 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 and then all of a sudden, voila, you hear pa, 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 pa. And the babies show this change, this ability to discriminate right here at the boundary for all the sounds of all languages in the first period of life. They can hear all the distinctions and show this ability to discriminate right at the boundary. And in 1975, I demonstrated that this was not only true of babies, it's also true of other mammals. So in animals like chinchillas and monkeys, I demonstrated that hearing for speech is better right at the boundary. So this went against the idea that the mechanisms of language evolved de novo in humans, but instead that there is a continuity and evolution that language came together in bits and pieces, and some of those bits and pieces exist in non-human animals. So the ability to have keen perception right at the boundary between phonemes exists in animals and also in babies. So how do we test the babies to know that they can hear the distinctions not only in English or in French, but in all the languages of the world? Well, this is a conditioned head turn technique that was invented at the University of Washington in Seattle to test hearing, and I adapted it to study speech perception. And in the technique, the baby is sitting on a mother or a father's lap, and there's an assistant who is playing with toys, moving the toys and keeping the baby's attention to the right side. And at the same time, there's a sound playing out of the loudspeaker, like ah, ah, ah. The baby's job is to listen for a change and turn their heads when they hear the change for a visual reinforcer. So here is a baby, I'll show you a little movie, discriminating ah from e, turning their heads at the exact right time.
Can a baby as young as 6 months old hear the difference between two vowels? This baby is trained to look for the toy when the sound changes. She's being distracted, so she'll turn only when she hears the difference in sounds. The key question, will she turn before the toy lights up?
E, 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 E.
the baby's very smart and can do this very quickly. So we have been testing babies all over the world using this technique. I have laboratories in 8 different countries in which we use this head turn technique to test babies with the sounds of all languages. And using this technique and a variety of others, you can show that in the first 6 months of life, babies can discriminate any sound from any language. So French contrasts, phonetic contrasts that are important to French and not to English, or those that are important to Urdu or to Japanese, can be heard and differentiated by the young babies, but not by adults. So what the experiments demonstrated was that babies are citizens of the world. They can hear the distinctions in all the languages. But we as adults are culture-bound listeners. We can hear the differences in our own languages or any language that we were exposed to in the first 7 years of life, but not distinctions that are not used in our language. So we are culture-bound listeners. The babies are citizens of the world. So the first question is, when does that change? When do the babies change from citizens of the world to the culture-bound listeners? And the answer is they change before their first birthdays. What you see here is a graph showing the results of this head turn experiment run in Tokyo, Japan, and Seattle, Washington in America. And the babies are being tested on ra la. In English, this is a very important distinction, rake and lake. Read and lead. These are words discriminated by this R and L, but in Japanese it makes no difference. In Japanese you can use either sound and it is not going to change the meaning of the word. So you can see early in development the babies are equal with regard to their ability. 6 to 8 months they're equally good, and then 2 months later something very dramatic happens. The American babies who are listening to R's and L's in the American speech get better, and the Japanese babies who are not listening to R's and L's but Japanese R, which is midway between R and L acoustically, are getting much, much worse. But both groups of babies are preparing exactly as they should for learning English or Japanese. It's important that the Japanese baby ignore this distinction because it's not important in Japanese. It's important that the American babies learn that distinction. So by 1 year of age, when first words appear, the babies have already sorted out the sounds. You can also, so on one side of this line, they are citizens of the world. On this side of the line, they are more culture-bound listeners like we are. You can do the same kinds of measures with EEG. Here, the baby is wearing a cap. The cap has sensors in it that detect the electrical activity that's leaking from the scalp. This is a very easy technique to use. And the brain waves give you a signature of discrimination and sound differences that they can hear. And what we can see is that if you take a measurement of sound discrimination at 7.5 months, it predicts the growth of language to 30 months. So here's the baby in the cap listening to a sound from English. Here's a sound from another language. If they're very good at native discrimination, the sounds from their own language, the rate of word growth, if they're better, the top half of the distribution, better ERP discrimination at 7.5 months predicts growth of words out to 30 months, very fast. And if you're poorer at discrimination, then the growth of words is slower. And this is only true when you're listening to the sounds from your native language. If you're listening to non-native sounds, you grow words faster if you are ignoring the differences between the non-native sounds. So it's important that the babies are listening and beginning to focus on the sounds that they're hearing in their language. So this 2-month period between 8 months and 10 months is very important for the development of sounds. It's what we call this sensitive period for sound development. So what's going on in the baby brain during that 2 months? And what I want to demonstrate to you is that there are two important things going on. One of them is computational, the statistical learning, a kind of computational approach to learning that babies are capable of. And the second thing has nothing to do with computation. It has to do with the baby's social abilities. So the new view that we are creating is that Babies are combining implicit learning, computational learning, with a social approach to reacting to individual people. So I'll demonstrate that. Let's first talk about the computational part. So I want you to listen to two women speaking what's called motherese. Motherese is a signal that babies universally really like. It has a unique sound, a very high pitch, very interesting pitch contours, and very slow, so the babies can listen and respond. You're going to hear an American speaking English to her baby, and then a Japanese mother speaking Japanese to her baby. So here we go.
Eyes so pretty and nice.
Wow, 大きな茶色いお目目! そして綺麗な黒い髪!
Okay, so babies love listening to this motherese signal in any language, and it has the sweeping contour. So what are the infants doing while they listen? Well, the experiments all over the country in the US, but in world laboratories, are showing that the babies are paying attention to the statistics of the sounds, the statistics of the number of sounds that are coming in of a particular type. In essence, this is what they are doing. When they listen to English, they are sensitive to the number of R's and L's in the language. And this is what the distribution of English looks like with regard to R's and L's. This is what the Japanese woman's statistics look like. She is producing Japanese R, but not American English R and L. Now, these statistics matter to the baby. You can change what the babies pay attention to and change their discrimination abilities in the laboratory by changing the distributions of the statistics. You can change in 2 minutes how the babies will listen. You can make them listen like Japanese or listen like English by changing these distributions of sounds. So the baby's mind is taking into account statistics, and it matters what the baby's listening to. And these experiments have been demonstrated not just for auditory stimuli, but for visual stimuli and other kinds of sensory information. So the baby brain is absorbing what's happening in the world, auditorily, visually, and perhaps in all other possible ways. And these statistics, what they see and what they hear, is changing the mind of the baby. This is what is changing the baby from a universal citizen of the world to a very culture-bound listener, because the baby is being bathed in language from you and I as adults. So it is important that we talk to babies because they're learning from us speaking to them. And I can show you a little bit about what motherese looks like. This is a recording of a mother in the laboratory. I'm plotting her adult-directed speech and infant-directed speech. This is the pitch of her voice. So when she talks to an adult, she says, I had a little bit and the doctor gave me Bendectin for it. So it's a typical fundamental frequency. But then she turns to her baby on her lap and she says, can you say ah? Say ah. Hey, you. Say hi. Hi. It's very high. It's too high for this time of the day. And there's no baby here, so it's difficult to do this. But this is how the mothers across the world speak to their babies, fathers too, people of all ages when they address infants. Infants really like listening to this. If you give them a choice, they will do whatever they have to do to listen to motherese in any language. So what motherese does is stretch, because it's so long and slow, it stretches the distributions, the statistical distributions. We showed in a paper in Science in 1997 that in English and Russian and Swedish, if you take the vowels, these are E, A, U in English, Russian, Swedish. The red triangles are how we speak to the babies. The blue triangles, how we speak to each other. When we speak to the babies, we speak much more clearly, much more slowly, and it's better for the baby brain. When we talk to each other, we use a smaller differentiation, we speak more quickly, and we don't articulate so clearly. So we're working hard when we talk to babies to make it clear for them. I think this is extremely good for the developing brain. We've shown that the more parents use this extended, stretched set of sounds, the better baby discrimination is. And when infants are trying to imitate, this is important because if the mother's vowels, E, A, and U, from an acoustic standpoint, are in this location, the baby's vocal tract is much smaller. So the baby's vocal tract is producing a much higher frequency, but imitating the sounds of the adult. This ability and interest, social interest in speech is important because for children with autism, do not prefer to listen to mothery speech. I will play for you this non-speech sound. They would rather listen to non-speech than to speech. Typical children would much prefer speech over the non-speech analog that's matched in sounds but doesn't sound like speech. And I'll play you these sounds right now. This is the motherese.
Look what I have. Look what I have. It's a pot.
She's saying, look what I have. It's a pot. And here's the non-speech analog. That's a very different sound. But the children with autism prefer it much more than the speech. They will listen to the speech once or twice, but then they will turn on over and over this non-speech analog. We think that this may be a biomarker for autism. We can do this auditory preference test really early in development at about 15 weeks. And we're now testing in a clinical trial the siblings, the baby siblings of children with autism, families in which there is one child with autism. We're now testing the baby brothers and sisters of these children with autism with this test in hopes that it will help us diagnose autism much, much sooner. And then we would be able to produce interventions earlier in development when the brain is plastic. But this work has led to a new hypothesis. And the hypothesis is that the social brain gates the computational abilities of babies. So babies are capable of statistical learning, but in real language learning with complex language, we are arguing that they need a social stimulus. They need to be in social interaction with us in order to take statistics on language. And this hypothesis is coming from the work on autism and the work with developmental abilities in typical children. So I want to set up the test that led us to this hypothesis. And the test starts with exposure to Mandarin Chinese. We had done experiments in Taipei and in the United States that look very much like the Japanese-American experiments. So here we're testing Chinese sounds at 6 to 8 months, at 10 to 12 months in Taipei and in Seattle. At 6 to 8 months, the babies in Taipei and Seattle are exactly the same, about 65% correct. And then 2 months later, it's the Taiwanese babies who are getting a lot better, and the American babies are getting a lot worse. So it's the same situation as you saw with Japanese RL in the babies in Tokyo and the United States. So we decided to expose the American babies to Mandarin Chinese for the first time during this critical period between 8 and 10 months. So we brought American babies into the laboratory and they listened to the graduate students and postdocs who were from Taiwan or from China. Their native language was Mandarin. So they played with the babies on the floor for 12 sessions between 9 and 10 and a half months, so 25 minutes each time. And they heard 4 different talkers, so it was a very natural kind of situation. So I'll play for you some example of what the sessions look like.
早安，飞！嗨，我们要来讲一个故事哦。今天要讲的故事是《小熊七七探险记》。来看看发生了什么事情哦。小小熊七七在这里。好，哦，有一天啊，小小熊七七。How
is your Mandarin skill coming along? Are you learning anything? So the babies really liked these sessions. They paid very close attention to the Mandarin speech and to the speakers and watched the face of this baby.
一个绿色的圈圈，绿色的圈圈，绿色的圈圈，再转一下。
转一圈，嘿，一圈，再一次哦，转一，一，二，三，两个圈，再一个，一，二。
Okay, so did they learn anything? So what did we do to their brains as we exposed them to a brand new language for the first time at 9 months? So we had to run a control group because maybe just coming into the laboratory was very exciting and it would cause them to pay more attention to the sounds. So we brought in 32 babies who listened to the American graduate students and they heard English. So the same books and the same toys and the same dosage, but they heard English. So here's the control group. Exposure to English for 12 sessions did not change the baby's Mandarin skills. And this is good because it means that we had a legitimate experiment. Here's what happened to the babies exposed to Mandarin for 12 sessions. So at this critical moment in development at 9 months, the babies learned so much from simply listening to the Mandarin, they are exactly as good as the babies in Taipei who had been listening for 10 and a half months. So at this point in development, if you present a language to a baby, they will absorb the information about the sounds. In later experiments with Spanish, we've shown they not only learn the sounds, they learn new words. So words of Spanish that they hear for the first time, as opposed to words they did not hear during the sessions, their brains are responding to those words in Spanish. So words and phonemes are absorbed in 12 sessions. Now, the babies were so good at this learning, this implicit learning at this time, we decided we needed to run this condition. We wondered, what did the human being have to do with this learning? Is the human being important or not? A statistical approach, the computational process, all the babies have to do is listen to the sounds, and their brains will absorb the sounds and they will learn. But we began to think that this social stimulation was really important because the babies were so engaged with the speakers. So we ran 32 babies watching on a beautiful DVD television, the same sessions, the same 12 sessions that the other babies had heard. So 32 new babies are now listening over a television and watching the DVDs. And one more group came in and just heard the sounds, heard the language, and they watched a teddy bear on the screen. So we have an audio group, 32 babies, and auditory visual group. So what did we do to the babies' brains when they watched over a television? So here is the result for the audio. These are the kids who just heard auditory, no learning whatsoever. It didn't matter that they had heard 12 sessions of audio. Here's the video condition. Absolutely no learning whatsoever. Now, this was a big surprise because the babies were really looking at the television set. They seemed to love the television set. They stare at it, they go up to it. Some of the babies would kiss the screen and they would try to take the toys from the screen. So they seemed to be engaged in the screen, but nothing happened. Nothing happened in their brains, no learning. So the lesson from this, we believe, is that in biology, there's something very special about human-to-human interaction, that we need a social stimulus to learn. The social stimulus turns the learning mechanisms on in a very unique way. That babies in a real environment do not learn simply by taking the statistical computational approach. In experiments in the laboratory, when they're just listening to syllables for 2 minutes, they can learn something, but it's not a lasting effect. And that is not sufficient for a natural language. In natural language, it's terribly complex. And babies are using everything that's there, the statistics, the humans' movements. The babies follow the humans' movements. They eye gaze follow. We showed in experiments on the Spanish that the more babies were socially engaged with the tutor, the more their brains were showing learning after the 12 sessions. So both with phonemes and words, the more eye gaze following, so if the tutor holds up a toy and describes it in Mandarin or in Spanish, the babies look at the toy, they look at the tutor, back and forth between the tutor and toy. They want to know that the tutor's looking at this when this is being named. So they're using social skills. The social brain is being used to map information. So it's not just computation, it's partly social. Now, we don't know exactly what's going on, whether it is the eye gaze following or whether it's arousal. The babies are highly aroused in these settings. When they are waiting in the waiting room, they watch the door to see when their tutor is coming in. They get very excited. And the babies who are coming in to watch the television, they're not excited. They stare at the television, but they're not excited. So we think there's something about the biology of human learning that isn't just from a machine. A machine is not the same. I'm going to mention very briefly, because time is getting short, about the bilingual children. We're looking in the United States, very few people in the United States are bilingual. And more, there are children in our schools who do not understand English. Their home language is something else. There are many Hispanics in the United States now where the native language is Spanish. They're coming to American schools in which the teachers know English but not Spanish, and that's true for a variety of other languages. And so we're trying to understand, both from an educational standpoint and the brain, how does a brain map two languages? And what we see in very detailed studies of the brain and the home environment is that the listening to two languages has two very interesting effects. The first effect of listening to a language is that you elongate the period over which learning occurs. So instead of 2 months, from 8 to 10 months, it looks as though the baby stays open for a longer period of time. So they are not narrowing as rapidly. If you're listening to two languages, you're narrowing your perception more slowly. And that seems important because it shows that the biology is being affected by culture. The more variability you hear in the language input, the longer the mechanism takes to learn. And then the second thing has to do with cognitive flexibility. Babies who are exposed to two languages are cognitively more flexible. So that when you give them a problem to solve, and it's a timed solution, they will be more quick, they will be more accurate and faster at creating a new solution to a novel problem than monolingual babies. So that constant switching from one language to another makes the brain more flexible. And that flexibility is not just for language, but for other things in the world, for problem solving in general. Now, I want to switch a little bit to brain development before the end. And we're not only doing this whole host of measures with regard to behavior, we're very interested in the most modern methods of measuring the brain. So you saw the CAP, the event-related potential CAP. That's one method. We've been using that for 10 years or so. It's very, very good. But we're interested in seeing deeper in the brain to see the structures in the brain and how social and language areas of the brain interact. So we've done a number of things. One is to create, this is a technical point, but one of the problems with doing baby neuroscience is that the baby brain is not the same as the adult brain. The adult brain, the neuroscientists have mapped the brain very carefully. There are models of the adult brain so that you know precisely how the average brain of an adult looks, but no one has developed the average brain for a baby. So I won't go through this, but I just want to mention that we are now producing average brains for 6-monthers and 12-monthers. And it's a very complicated procedure, but what we end up with is detailed studies of the brain of a 6-monther or the brain of a 12-monther, and we have quite a few baby brains that we're now averaging, so you know exactly where the structures are in a baby brain, and that's important, because then we're able to create an atlas that allows us to look at individual sections of the brain and to look at the tissue, white matter, gray matter, and cerebral spinal fluid. And these little measures of the brain are very important because you can see relationships between gray matter and particular areas of the brain. For example, the cerebellum, not only the language areas, but areas having to do with learning and memory. So these are individual babies, and the gray matter in their brains in this particular location on the right side of the cerebellum, you can see relationships. between the baby's receptive language scores and the amount of gray matter in a particular area of the brain. We can see also measurements related to the language they're hearing at home. So the more words, in America there have been quite a few studies showing that children growing up in poverty, by the time they're at the age of 5, they have heard 30 million fewer words. Very different language environments in poor families where there's not much talking going on to the children. And when you look at the brain measures of the children in poverty at the age of 5 and children growing up in a typical socioeconomic status, the brain differences in gray matter and white matter reveal and correlate strongly with the language acquisition, the amount of language the kids have heard. So other areas of the brain too, in the hippocampus, these are all corrected. These are highly significant correlations. And the idea is that we're going to be able to see structural shifts in the brain that depend upon the environment of the child. So these are certain kinds of structural measures. Another kind of structural measure looks at DTI, diffusion tensor imaging. And here you see those superhighways in the brain, that the fibers that allow the electrical signals to be traveling very rapidly from one brain area to the other. We're really interested in the fiber tracts surrounding the corpus callosum because that's the connections in the middle of the brain that allow the right hemisphere to talk to the left hemisphere. And we're interested in a particular connecting highway for language, which is called the arcuate. And the arcuate relates Broca's area. It's the highway connecting Broca's area for speaking with Wernicke's area for listening. This is what gets damaged in aphasia in adults. It gets damaged in children with aphasia and language difficulties. So I'm going to show you a little movie of a 12-month-old brain that shows you the capability that we're now developing. So this is the segmented brain. And here this surface peel, this is one individual 12-monther. And you can see the detail. And then inside the brain, this is the tractography showing the connections to the corpus callosum. This is the arcuate in a 12-monther. And we can see huge individual differences between 12-monthers, the arcuate in a 12-monther, where the connections are. And we think these differences will relate to the baby's environment, their language skills, and the growth of their language capabilities. So it simply illustrates what we're capable of doing structurally with the white matter and gray matter segmentation and the DTI that allows you to see the fiber tracts. And then finally, we want to see functional activity in the brain. We're now using whole brain imaging, magnetoencephalography, or MEG. The MEG machine looks like a giant hairdryer from Mars, but it's completely safe and non-invasive. It's got a helmet. That's why we say it looks like a hairdryer. You sit under the helmet, and it records the magnetic fields that are created as millions of neurons are active at once. And this is done all with no, it's like a stethoscope. It's just listening to the brain, measuring the magnetic fields with squids. So this is 306 squids in the helmet that are recording at each location the magnetic fields. And that allows you to pinpoint with millimeter accuracy and millisecond accuracy where the activity is going on in the brain. Now, this is important because you get whole brain activity. It's not noisy. It is completely non-invasive, completely safe. And we're the first ones in the world in Seattle to record a baby in an MEG machine. So this baby is listening to language. We're doing experiments in which the baby is listening either live or on listening from a television set to language. We want to see what's happening in the brain. We're measuring the activity. And we're watching her head move. So we have GPS tracking that sees where her head is. She's got little pellets on the head so she can move and be totally comfortable. And we can still see where the brain is at all minutes. So the setup is pretty elaborate. We make the laboratory. This is the little cap that she wears to track her head. And we cap the babies and digitize by marking, just touching the scalp so we know exactly where that point is. and then get her into position for the MEG recording. She wears a little foam rubber, like a halo, that allows her to fit and be comfortable. So we can see the activity in the brain. This is MEG data in the auditory area and in the motor areas. In a newborn, you can see that when they hear a word, you have activity in the sensory area, but not the motor. And then as you move to 6 months and 12 months, you can see that there's more and more activity in the motor system as the baby, when the baby hears a word, their motor speech areas are getting ready to talk back. So you can see that activity. Again, more detailed data that we won't take too much time to go through, but looking at this motor area, this Broca's area is extremely interesting to understand what's happening as babies listening to sounds at these two different ages and trying to imitate what they hear us produce. So in conclusion, I simply want to say that there are many new techniques. The behavioral science has been leading the way for 30 years, but the new measures that we're seeing with neuroscience allowing us to take structural, very, very refined structural measures and see the individual differences in babies at the same age and then see the change from 6 months to 12 months to a year and a half to 3 years of age. It's a golden age in which we're going to be able to understand what's really happening as the child is living in one environment as opposed to another. I think we're going to be able to answer profound questions about how people learn, what makes us different from our animal relatives, what makes the mind so absorbing of information early in development, and how is that absorption changed by social interaction. So I think what we can conclude is that the infant learning that was envisioned by Skinner is not the kind of learning that's going on when children are interacting with humans and learning language. This is implicit learning, a kind of learning that was not known to exist in children when Skinner was writing about learning. So it's a new version of a learning theory that's changing our minds with regard to how children learn. So it's this computational skill. There's no doubt babies are grabbing statistics from the environment, but the new news is that they're gathering this information in social context. The social context changes everything. This social gating may help explain autism, because children with autism are not interested in the social signal. They are frightened by voices that are modulated like motherese. They do not like to look at the face. They are frightened by eyes. So the social piece of the brain is not functioning in the way typically developing children's brains are functioning. That may prevent them from paying attention to the statistics. So it's going to help us explain autism. Motherese seems to be an ideal signal to learn from, because it stretches the distributions and captures infants' attention. Phonetic learning, so early measures of the attention to sound, predicts language out to the age of 3, and we have new findings suggesting it goes all the way to the age of 5. So you can measure a baby's ability to hear sound differences at 7.5 months and predict how well that baby will do, that child, at pre-reading tests at the age of 5. So that early learning period is really important. Bilingualism affects the brain in two ways. It stretches the critical period. It isn't the 2 months from 8 to 10. It's a longer learning period. And it also changes cognitive flexibility. Hearing two languages from the beginning of life makes your brain more cognitively flexible. And then finally, neuroscience is going to be an amazing tool to use in the next decade. We'll learn a tremendous about the typically developing child, about children with disabilities, and at the same time, we may be able to discover what is it about our own brains that change? Why, if we created the exact conditions that babies learn under, why is it that the adult brain doesn't learn as well? Can we turn that around? Can we make us stay as open as the child is? So finally, a new view is emerging that has a learning mechanism, a cultural learning mechanism that's different than Skinner envisioned. It is also different from what Chomsky envisioned. It's not simply that languages trigger an option that's pre-stored in the brain. There's a dynamic construction of what the environment provides that is giving babies a very early and rapid acquisition, even before the age of one. So thank you for your attention, and maybe there'll be some questions.